Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 70 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is 2024, Year of the Wood Dragon, and this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Leskovansky. I almost said your last name first. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Pretty well. Things are finally starting to calm down in repotting season here.
Yeah, same.
So yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about post repotting season blues and going into the spraying and all that good stuff. But we're also talking about wisteria as bonsai. So I think this is a topic that, I mean, this is something I'm definitely interested in because wisteria grow really well in Southeast Louisiana. They're quite invasive here. So There has to be a way to improve the way we care for them here. I know a lot of people struggle with them here. But apparently up where you're at, Carmen, they do pretty well for you guys as well. And it's not difficult to work with.
Well, I mean, you know, they have their moments.
Yeah. And we'll dive into that. We have some wisteria as bonsai care facts to go over. But before we get into that, I do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing Patreons over on at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head on over there, become a Bonsai Best Bud, and hang out in the Discord and chat Bonsai with all of them and share all of your cutting challenge submissions and your Bonsai tree critiques or development stock pieces with us so we can critique them on the show like you've heard us do in the past. So I'm going to go ahead and just say we have a brand new Bonsai Best Bud featured. It's going to be Eduardo Fernandez. Thank you so much for sponsoring the show. That's awesome. Also, we do a callback on some of our older Bonsai Best Buds just to kind of shout their name out because I don't read off the list anymore. So featured Best Bud this week is going to be Laurent's Bonsai Yard. Thank you so much. I wish I could see that Bonsai Yard. It sounds kind of cool with a name like Laurent. And then we have our main show sponsor. Ooh, did Carmen drop out?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay. You're just so quiet. We have our main show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools, with John. Thank you so much, John, for supporting us and Joshua Roth Tools being our main sponsor. They just helped us print our brand new long sleeve t-shirts that we have that say I'm into heavy metal with a metal, like metalcore shout out lyric, like make the cut on the sleeve. It's a pretty dope shirt. With a bald cypress on the other side. Those are currently listed online. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com. There's a tab for little things, and the shirts are available there for purchase, and they can be shipped out to anywhere in the United States. We're still trying to figure out international shipping at the moment, but we'll get there in the future, hopefully. And then, of course, we have our specimen best buds. I need to go ahead and shout those guys out. Awesome, top tier that you can sponsor us at. It's always so amazing to know people want to sponsor us at this level. So thank you, Unryuin, Bonsai Garden, Christina, Carforia, and of course, Bill's Bayou being the anchor best bud on the list as always. And then also go check out Matt O'Donnell. He's our editor. He makes us sound smart. He cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. Go over to mattodonnell.com, fill out a contact form, start your own podcast show with him or an audio engineering project with him. He's a set bassist living in Nashville, Tennessee, and is an all-around awesome guy. It's in the script to say it every single time. And go check out Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know, his podcast show that he just released about a month or so ago. And I think he's currently on episode 5, I believe. So, but yeah, he's got some good interviews going on there. He's talking to musicians and content creators and other creatives on how they make their careers work, you know, people who have unique jobs and unique interests and hobbies and skills. It's just an all-around really cool show to listen to. We were chatting a little bit right before we started recording about repotting season. I know I just talked to you about how you just finished up seasonals with the Hagedorn Garden. Or the Cartagus Garden, I'm sorry, or Cartagus, I always get that wrong. How many seasonals do y'all usually run up there?
So for repotting, we usually, you know, we started out, I think my first year we just did two. Last year we tried to do three, but one of them got kind of snowed out. And this year we did three. So usually we only do two seasonals per season. So these are the 3-day intensive classes. But for repotting, we usually run three of them because there's one, a ton of interest, and two, it's a really great way to like set up people to come back for further learning. We like to start students off with repotting just so they have the basics down. And yeah, so we had I think every class was pretty much full. So it was we didn't do as much repotting this year as, you know, we've done in the past. Some seasonals, it's just kind of been one tree after another. And this year it was a little bit slower paced, which was fine. Cause we did a couple relatively, I guess what you would consider normal repots, you know, just your standard, like it's been a bonsai for a long time. Take it out of the pot, refresh the soil, put it back in the pot, you're done. Mm-hmm. And then we always do one or two projects per seasonal that's, you know, maybe a Yamadori or something that needs to get partially bare rooted or an interesting, like,
something experimental.
We haven't really done any like planting, like interesting plantings yet this season, as far as like, you know, not in a pot, but there's a couple I think coming up. And so there's always, you know, a little bit of variety. And yeah, it was a good time. Met some new students and saw some old friends. So it was good. It was weird. You weren't here this year. The last yeah. 2 years, you've been here for winter seasonal. It was strange. Yeah.
I've been really, really busy planning out, of course, bonsai. Well, of course, yeah, bonsai overall. But no, say bonsai.
I've been busy with bonsai.
I've been busy with bonsai. Yeah, but like planning an event. And a show has taken up a lot of my brain space. Also, making sure I'm ready for BCI and, of course, Bonsai Central. So, yeah, I wish I could have gone out there this season, but I just needed to stay here at the nursery.
You've been doing a ton of repotting, too. So many. Like, I've seen so many photos. Just you're just like a machine. Just
yeah, and you should out. See. You should see our up potting process where we're just taking cuttings from last year and now they're from pinky size up past thumb size, most of them, because they grow so fast here and our growing season doesn't really stop. For instance, the Chinese elms that we have taken cuttings from, they took like a 1 month break. Mm-hmm. So they dropped their leaves in January and then in February they were already starting to grow buds. And this like today when day of recording, like I've got like 3-inch extensions on all those trees.
Oh my God. That's so crazy.
They just don't take a break. So a lot of that up potting stuff, a lot of the behind the scenes kind of like taking the trees to the next step from cutting, you know, from seedling cutting up to the next size. And then of course cutting them again. And then I've been very fortunate to have Guy Guidry come to the nursery. He's been helping me make some selection on larger trees, like cutting and carving line into nice trunks so we can have some big premium size trident maples and bald cypresses are available in the near future here. And yeah, just the regular repots. I've got a couple of clients that I've just been driving a couple hours out of my way to go see here and there to go repot their collections. And like you said, get some older trees, refresh them with new soil. Now that our bonsai soil mix is starting to get out there and into the ethos in Louisiana area, we got a lot more people. It's becoming more demand for our soil. So I'm repotting trees that are in haydite and pure peat moss soils with pine bark and sand, and we're getting them into those kind of root balls, if they've been in there for a while, kind of a nightmare to work through.
Yeah.
That has been a real big process. But yeah, I'm finally starting to also see a couple of trees that I've dug up about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, going well on almost here. And like I showed you that trident maple that I potted up in that blue fire and myrick. And it's just like, I'm finally getting to see like not the end result, but like all the work's paying off on a lot of big trees that I've been working on for the past couple of years now. So yeah,
that's a good feeling. Yeah, we've moved a couple of trees from like Anderson flats or nursery pots into bonsai pots. And I always love that transition because it feels like it's a, you know, it's a big milestone for the tree. And it really shows you the progress you've made over time. So that's always one of my favorite things to do.
Oh yeah. And I love also seeing the handling of the root systems in a certain way. Like, for instance, when we dig the trident maples out of the field, and when they're cut really nice and flat with their initial chops on their roots to kind of get them plated so that they will not have issues in the future to be put into a bonsai container. There's so much like benefit that you don't get to see for several years. And then when you pull it out of there and you're like expecting a nightmare because of some of the older material and older stock that I used to work with, and you pull these tridents out and all you have to do is just take off a few inches on the bottom and it goes straight into its first bonsai container. It's just like magic.
Yeah.
You know? So the bald cypresses still fight back a good bit because they are so coarse in their root system. And the elm trees, of course, they can be a running root nightmare where I've combed out roots so long that I've held the tree above my head and the roots are still touching the ground and like draped across.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's ridiculous sometimes. And they'll be in bonsai pots. They'll be in an actual container, like shallow container, like maybe an inch or two deep. And they'll have a running root that's like 4 feet long. It's insane. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how much root they can squeeze into those pots. It's cool. We ran into I think it was a juniper root yesterday that was going straight through a piece of pumice, which was really fun to see.
You like to see that, yeah.
Yeah, I love it when the roots are actually, like, you cannot take the pumice off because you'll break the root because the root is in the pumice. It's really fun.
Yeah. And that's what we want to see because, like, Akadama is supposed to do that as well. Mm-hmm. But whenever a root gets into Akadama, it usually splits it. But to see it go straight through a pumice particle, that's pretty cool, you know?
It was really cool.
Yeah. And so, like, I've got a winged elm broom. I sent you a picture of that tree. Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at the soil surface and seeing how the soil is beautifully integrated into the fine fibrous roots on the soil surface. When I cleaned up when I cleaned that layer of just crap, because you know this, but for our listeners,
I love that for like the exposed and the nabari, like that first quarter inch taking off the top and seeing what roots are there and cleaning it. Oh, I love that.
It looks really pretty, and it's like when it's all right. When everything is just done, everything's webbed together like this big giant sponge with roots like and just encrusted in it. Mm-hmm. You know, you did something right, because that crust, that layer that sits on top of there, if you're organically feeding your trees, which I do a lot of here, you'll get a organic cap is what they call it. And then there's, of course, this orchid moss or the sphagnum moss is on top of there, too, with your moss that's growing on top. And I know for you guys in Portland currently, there's just so much moss there, and people ask me all the time, like, how do you get that to grow in there? And I was like, I wish it wouldn't grow so often.
Yeah.
So that's another part of it.
You have to control it. It's too much.
Guy actually brought up something interesting to me. And he's been really pushing, like, every time I see him, and he's also tried to like help mentor a little bit too. Every time he sees me, he likes to repeat things, and he's like, okay, all these trees that we were repotting, go back with a light dusting of organic, like he's talking about like a soil conditioner, like pine bark and a little bit of sand. Mm-hmm. And he wants to put like a quarter inch layer on there, and he's calling that his cap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just the same thought process of doing a thin layer of orchid moss, sphagnum moss, and then also a little bit of you guys at the garden there, y'all just use moss, right?
Yeah, we use sphagnum moss, and we'll cut like live green moss into it so that it like is inoculated a little bit, and sometimes for the conifers, like for the pines or drier species, we'll use just a smaller size of soil, so like instead of using our pine mix, we'll top it with a deciduous mix or something, just so that, because what you want, regardless of what you're using for your top dressing, the whole point is to have something a little bit smaller that holds a little bit more water that helps stabilize the soil underneath so the fine roots can grow up to that top layer. If you just have your loose, chunkier soil all the way up, a lot of times you won't see roots in that first, you know, quarter inch, half an inch, because the soil's just not stable. There's not enough water. So yeah, any kind of top dressing. That's an interesting top dressing. I mean, I imagine it's, if it's worked for him, it's, I can't really see much, you know, much of a difference. It's going to decompose over time. And so does our sphagnum moss. And
it's,
you know, as long as you're maintaining your, the top of your soil, it seems like, yeah, that would work just fine.
The argument with him, and it's not an argument, it's just kind of like, cause he's been doing it for so long. This is like his thing. He leans into it. He's like, use potting soil mix. And I'm like, potting soil is sphagnum moss. Like peat moss.
It's, yeah, it's peat. So it's a little bit different, but it's similar concepts. Yeah.
Well, so similar. So just really quick before we get into wisterias, you bring that up, and that's something that like I had made an assumption on for a while now. So peat versus sphagnum.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference there?
So sphagnum is it's actually a type of live moss that is collected and then dried, and then sold as, you know, orchid grow mix or sold as orchid mix or orchid moss or for terrariums or whatever. So it's actually like if you took moss off of the top of your bonsai, dried it out, shredded it and bagged it up. I mean, it's a different species of moss, but it's kind of the same concept. Peat is decomposed organic matter from like swamps and bogs. Okay. So it's not the same as a moss. I think it's more like decomposed moss and decomposed other organic components. I should Google it. I don't really know for sure. But it's, so peat is not actually a species of moss. It's like a,
is it Scotch whiskey that had the peat?
Well, that would look.
Caitlin actually got me a little piece of wood that's called, we call it the peat man. But he's a little chunk of wood that's been carved to look like a little, it's from a bog. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. It's a little chunk of peat and it's black and it's an old aged decomposed piece of wood and you can smell it and it has a peat smell. It's peaty. And so they have Scotch whiskeys. I know you can't, the viewers can't see this, but there you go.
Hold on. I'm on a different window. Let me click back. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's hair. Creepy. I love it.
But yeah, this is peat, man. But yeah, whenever she initially got me this piece of peat, it came from, that was from Scotland. And it smelled really strong. And if you've ever had a good Scotch whiskey that has a peat note in it, you can smell, it smelled just like the whiskey. It's very smoky smelling. Maybe this block. Go ahead.
It's decomposed sphagnum moss with other organic components in it. So it's from a bog. So it's like from the same, it's like in the same kind of family as like just dried sphagnum, but it's a little bit more broken down than like the actual just sphagnum moss.
Yeah.
But I've seen people use it in bonsai mix kind of as, you know, as a similar, as an organic component to hold a little bit more moisture. It's, you know, it's similar.
Yeah. We're all learning here. So, okay, cool. But yeah, so let's crack into wisteria for a bonsai. And so what I've seen from wisteria, so we're talking about, I think it's straight up like their Latin name is just wisteria. That's why we have, that's why we have that name. It's not like a common name or anything.
Right. Yeah. There's the two, there's the Japanese wisteria, which is Wisteria floribunda. And there's the Chinese wisteria, which is Wisteria sinensis. So yeah, there's sinensis. Two species, but wisteria
species that are very common.
Common name.
When you see these, I think one of the first times I ever saw a wisteria bonsai was on the cover of Amy Lean's. Is that her name? Amy Lean, the Living Art of Bonsai book. It's a hardcover book, tradition, like usually when it's printed, and it's got this is it a wisteria? Hold on. I haven't seen the book in a while. It's either an azalea or a wisteria. She was really well known for her wisterias too. Just make sure real quick. Nope, that's an azalea. What was there is a wisteria in that book. So it's Living Art of Bonsai by Amy Ling. And it's in the very front where they have like most bonsai books have this, where they'll have like a little gallery where you flip through like high resolution, nice color images. And there's this wisteria in there. And it's flowering like crazy purple, beautiful blooms. It's hard to tell how big it is, but mm-hmm. based off of my experience with wisterias thus far, the blooms look small. So that means that that tree is massive. In most cases, because the we'll get into like the more of like the details of how long everything is, like what all you need to do to make them grow well and what they should look like. But yeah, it's kind of one of those dream bonsai plants where I know it's like in the top, like when people Google bonsai and they see like Japanese maples with red leaves on them and they think, oh, I want a red Japanese maple, but that's not the case. That's just like, that's their spring mm-hmm. bloom color and they turn green. And then when they're in the fall color, they might turn red like that, depending on how you did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the wisteria is kind of like in that same pool. It's like, oh, beautiful. Like the flowers on that are amazing. But like what we don't know when we start bonsai, that's like barely like what, like a month's time where it blooms like that?
Yeah, maybe. It's a very ephemeral plant as far as, you know, your display window. Your display window is, you know, depending on your weather, 1 to 4 weeks in the spring when it's blooming. And that's kind of it. So the rest of the year, it's just kind of, you know, existing until it blooms again.
Yeah. And the leaves are compound leaves. And their leaflets are the stems. Is that what you call that part in the middle of that compound?
So the compound leaf, I don't know, I'm trying to think how I would say it. It's pinnately compound, so like a feather, right? So it's got that kind of central stem with all the little leaves kind of coming off that central stem, opposite of each other.
It has a tendency to look, because of the compound leaf, to me, it has a tendency to look a little bit more tropical when it's like leafed out. Mm-hmm. Because the leaves will have a tendency to kind of like, they'll solar panel like kind of sideways and tilt it towards the sun, literally like mm-hmm. Because I mean, that's their purpose, obviously. But yeah, usually the leaves are like very springy feeling, like straight up in the air. And then they get long and they kind of droop down on the sides. And so you get this really big, like cousin it looking thing when it doesn't have flowers on it.
It's kind of a mop.
it doesn't really look like anything impressive. So it's like one of the things you have to get right on your wisteria is not only do you have to have a way for it to be shaped to like flower properly, but it also has to have an impressive trunk to an extent. Otherwise it just kind of looks weird, you know?
Yeah.
So I've seen wisteria anywhere from like a few inches in diameter to just absolute monsters. Like the one in Michael's garden that I've seen, I don't know how big the trunk on that thing is, but it's huge.
Yeah. It's probably, we just repotted it again. It's probably, you know, 8 inches across. It's a big one. It's in a pot that I can't really carry on my own. So it's a large tree. It's one of those trees where, you know, people grow a lot of wisteria in their yards as vines. So if you can find one and like collect it from, you know, an old specimen, that's a great way to get a big trunk right away. But a lot of times you end up with, you know, seedlings that are, you know, the size of your thumb, and it takes a little while for them to get big enough to do anything interesting. But yeah, if you know anybody who's trying to get rid of a wisteria in their yard, you know, go dig it up.
Yeah. And be careful with chopping them down from like big pieces and leaving big wounds, because they are a vine. Mm-hmm. So they have a tendency to rot away real quick if they're not stabilized. And they'll have interesting looking deadwood features, but that is not going to last. It gets all nasty.
It's going to rot out.
And it gets like, I remember one of the things, like I had somebody who had one. I met someone that had this big one in their yard, and they dug it up, and then it started like making mushrooms and stuff on it. And they were like, "Oh, it's so cool looking." I was like, "Oh, that thing is not going to last very long."
Yeah.
They don't hollow very well either.
Yeah.
Really soft. In fact, very similarly to how we think and treat bougainvillea, as far as like their wood and how soft they can get. And now bougainvillea, of course, is a completely different plant, but it still is a vining species that doesn't take well to big chops. Uh-huh. Doesn't take very well to being like wired out to the point where you're trying to do big bends or anything, because it's
the mushy so vine. Brittle.
Yeah. Now if you're expert level at wiring, like some people I've seen, and you can wire a bougainvillea out with, in dealing with the thorns, you should be able to deal with the wisteria, but their growth tends to be very coarse as well. So there's not a lot of wiring going on. But but yeah, now we kind of have a little bit of a summary of it. Give us a little bit of a breakdown on just wisteria overall.
I think they're a really cool plant. They're challenging in that they drink a lot of water. So that's something that I think people struggle with a lot is how much do you water your wisteria? And, you know, my rule of thumb in the summertime is if I have a hose in my hand, the wisteria gets water. Like, it doesn't really matter if I just watered it. Like, it's going to get more water because these things dry out super fast if they're healthy. And they're, you know, a little bit tricky to grow and ramify because of those compound leaves and because of the tendrils. So, you know, there's a little bit more of a technique there, but otherwise, you know, standard bonsai soil, standard fertilizing, and, you know, you should be good to go. Yeah, I remember my first time encountering this giant wisteria at Michael's. I was in my second seasonal and I walk into the backyard. I have a photo of this. It was centered perfectly in the studio. So like when you walk up to the studio, you look through the doors, the big old wisteria sitting right there in the middle. The sun's shining in through the skylight right onto it. It's full bloom. It's got some tendrils thrown out. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And our first job was to cut off all the flowers and then defoliate it. So it was like, oh no. But it's, you know, kind of that's how you develop your wisteria. So it was, you know, you get to enjoy it and then you get to chop it all up.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we want to try to break down a little bit more today on this episode is, you know, treating them more like wisteria because there's nothing else that really gets the same treatment. And like you said, watering, if you have a hose in your hand, like I like that thought because I know some people ask me like, it's like the bald cypress water elm effect. It's like, do I water my water loving plants now? It's like, yes, all the time, every day.
Always.
Like nonstop. If you're just hanging out in your garden and you're just like, okay, just water everything, water the wisteria too. But of course the soil mix, like you said, I actually also asked, I shot Jonas a message earlier on and was asking him his opinion on bonsai soil mixes for wisteria. And he did say standard mix. Mm-hmm. And I remember me and you were talking and we had a different approach and I'm trying it. Smaller particle pumice and smaller particle Akadama 50-50, which I'm giving a shot right now.
Great. Yeah. We use, for our deciduous trees, we use 50% pumice, 50% Akadama in like a smallish size. If you need to hold more water, you can make your particle size a little bit smaller. You can add more Akadama. Those things should help hold water a little bit longer. And then as far as setting wisteria in a pan of water, you definitely can do that. The thing you want to be careful of is that it's not too much water so that the roots are always soggy and wet because that can cause root rot. So you want like just enough water that if the tree needs it, it'll wick it up, you know, through the bottom of the pot. But that, you know, that water goes away essentially like within the day and you have to refill it. So like don't set it in like 6 inches of water, maybe set it in an inch of water just to kind of give you that. You're trying to give it a buffer zone rather than soak it all the time. And that might help people kind of understand, you know, how much water to put in their pan. Even just, you know, an inch of water that's not, you know, touching the bottom of, you know, that can't be wicked up, but it's just kind of sitting under there to give more humidity could help as well. I've seen that done with azaleas as well, just to increase the humidity. So as that water evaporates, you know, it's evaporating up around the tree. The tree's not in the water. It's just, but it's getting that benefit of that humidity. So that's another option as well. But yeah, they love sun. They can take full sun in the summer. That will make you need to water it more. So we'll often keep them in, you know, 40 or 50% shade just to kind of cut down on how much we have to water. When it's in the sun, it's one of those, like, if it's in the sun in July, like, good luck. You're going to have to be, you might as well just have water on it all the time.
I think it's
a little bit of shade can help cut down your need for watering too.
I think it's interesting how you brought up the pan thing because it's been so, I don't know. So I feel like it's a little more understudied here in Louisiana.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody talking about the pan method. That's of course more of a, just a bald cypress water elm thing here. I've even seen buttonwoods. I'll take a buttonwood and put it in a pan of water to help it stabilize during the summer. But I've never heard about the wisteria thing. I've always been a little bit more cautious about that because of root rot, like you said.
Yeah.
I do have a wisteria at the nursery that I potted into a bonsai container, and it's been just kind of riding it out in soil mix. It really hasn't flowered. It's always just put leaves on. I think it gets over fertilized and it doesn't get enough sun, like you're saying.
That could be. Yeah.
But also, I think from some of the notes that we had shared earlier, I was kind of looking it over. It's like the year before, is this true? Like the year before each seed, every time that it flowers is crucial to it flowering the preceding year. Is that from what I'm reading?
I don't know. I need to look over that part, but
yeah, from what I remember, it's like if you have a stubborn wisteria that's not really flowering for you, then cutting, like do fertilize in the spring, but do it lightly.
Mm-hmm.
And because I read an article one time on wisteria where somebody said, don't fertilize at all because they're nitrogen fixing plants. And so they usually take care of themselves in the springtime when they're flowering. And then after the flowers, to promote, of course, leafy green solar panel and get really strong energy throughout the summer and to the fall, you want to fertilize as normal and then get as much sun as possible because that will set you up for next year's flower buds to take place.
Like, yeah.
So that's from what I'm kind of gathering.
I think it's the flowers are forming when you prune off those long tendrils. When you cut those back in the spring, the flower buds will form there. And then after those flower, you'll get ramification from that area. Those areas will send out new shoots. Yeah, you've got to cut back your tendrils. And you can do some defoliation techniques as well to increase ramification, which will then ultimately increase the number of flowers you get. Age of the tree is also important. I don't like when people say you have to withhold fertilizer in order to get flowers, because that's like essentially the idea for that is like, oh, you're stressing the tree out, so you're going to make it want to flower. But I have found that a tree has to be strong enough and healthy enough in order to produce flowers in the first place. So I think, too, when you're pruning it is probably crucial because you don't want to be pruning off your flower buds for the next year. So I think timing is important as well.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
So also like with pruning, so I think this might be one of the things that holds people up from being able to produce flowers on some of their wisterias is that if they don't control the tendrils, basically when they start extending and reaching and then they don't cut those back immediately, that's allowed to extend full length and then develop into a branch. Mm-hmm. That's going to carry more extension buds and less flowering buds. It's kind of how I'm gathering that. So also if someone's developing their wisteria and they don't really know what style or what branches they need to sustain the design that they're working with as well, if they're cutting back hard all the time, they're also losing that opportunity to get their wisteria to flower.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's this ongoing battle with people working with wisteria and thinking that, you know, if it's in development forever, which sometimes Wisteria kind of are, it's they're kind of they're a difficult plant to style. And that's one thing we will bring up here in just a moment, is different forms and appropriate styles for them, because it's kind of like a ginkgo. There's like only one way to really go with them. Yeah. Is that that's the Wisteria style. You could do a informal upright kind of thing, or a cascade, of course, but there's just a way you have to go about that. But I know people are constantly growing out Wisterias and trying to develop branches, and they're not sure what the branches are supposed to be or what they're supposed to look like. And like we mentioned earlier, they don't ramify. They have really, really coarse branches compared to a twiggy elm tree. I mean, Zelkova will make a billion twigs, where Wisteria will give you, what, a couple of twigs on a primary branch that you can maybe work into something. So, and you've worked with them a little bit more intensively than I have. So if you have input on branch development, please chime in there. I don't want to talk in circles about that.
So there's two kinds of growth on your Wisteria. There's the runner, and then there's, you know, just your usual leaves. And so the runners, I think, are what you would use to kind of create some of those structural branches. You know, if you need something to grow in a certain place, the runners are flexible enough, you can wire them into place. You can grow them out to whatever length you need. So you can kind of utilize those as you're building the structure of the tree. When you get into ramification, the ramification kind of comes from the flower stalks. So when at the base of the flower stalks, that's where some of your leaves are going to come from, and some of your finer twigging. I mean, as fine as it'll go, it's still pretty coarse. So there's a defoliation technique that can help you to ramify your Wisteria. So after everything's flushed out in the summertime, you can cut your flowers off. You can cut your tendrils off that you don't want, and then take that leaf. So, right, it's that compound leaf, and cut it back to those first two leaflets. So your tree's going to look kind of naked, but that's okay. And then you might want to put it in the shade for a little while, just so that you don't, like, it needs light. But after you, kind of with any tree that you defoliate, you want to kind of put it in shade for a little bit, just until it kind of recovers, and then you can move it into a little bit more light. But so as you cut that back, you're going to get more, you're going to get a second flush in a few weeks. And then that's going to give you the opportunity, you know, to ramify that tree. So we only really do one defoliation a year, unless that second flush throws out a tendril, then we'll cut that back if we need to. But that defoliation technique, once you've got your structure set, or as you're building your structure, can help to increase the ramification, and then will ultimately help increase, you know, flower buds for the following year.
So you should be using this defoliation on young stock and also more mature stock as well, just not as severe on younger stock.
Right. Yeah. If you're trying to thicken a branch, you know, shorten your tendril to where you want it to be, and then maybe let it grow until you have that thickness. But if it's as thick as you want it to be, then you can go ahead and defoliate. You could do kind of a mix and match, but usually when we're defoliating, we do the whole tree. But that's again, that's for more when you've got your structure set. So yeah, with a younger tree, don't worry as much about the flowers. Worry about setting your structure. They're a fast tree, so
you can make them quick.
I mean, we had a tendril. We had a problem with one of the Wisterias. I think it was last year. Got it too cold too late in the season, and I actually thought we were going to lose it, but it leafed out 2 or 3 weeks late, and then we just kind of let it go. Last year we only had a few flowers on it, but we had tendrils that were 6 feet long, and they were like climbing the hemlock that was next to it, but we just let them go until the fall and didn't worry about anything else, because we just wanted to be sure, you know, the tree retained its structure and had the strength to continue. So you know, it's kind of like with anything, if you have a problem, or if you're developing something like an azalea or a maple, you know, you want to focus on your development rather than, you know, making it all showy in those first few years.
Yeah. And that is something worth mentioning about these Wisteria as bonsai on your bench, is they are very grabby.
Okay.
So whatever is nearby, and they will do this in like a day's or like a day or 2 days time, the tendril will reach out and it will just grab something.
Yeah, turn your back for a second and it's got your leg. Like, you're got to watch out for those. There's one in our neighborhood that there's a Doug fir that's, I don't know, huge. And there's a wisteria that has climbed all the way to the top of it, which is amazing in the spring when it blooms, because you essentially have a Doug fir that's covered in wisteria blossoms. But like, I don't think that Doug fir is going to live much longer.
Yeah, they will strangle the crap out of whatever is whatever it's taking over. And that was one of the things that I mentioned way earlier, is they have a tendency to be very invasive here in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's just as bad. They love it there. Just as bad where you are in Portland right now. Is it bad in Michigan? Do they grow a lot? There is too cold.
No, they grow there, but mostly as landscape plants, and people struggle to get them to flower. I think it's kind of borderline for them. You know, like, we sell them and people have them, but it's, they don't grow as well as they do here, or in slightly warmer areas.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I can imagine in Louisiana with the humidity and the amount of water and the long growing season that they just.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, I can see that.
They, you don't really see them. Of course, you can't see them on the ground. They're actually pretty difficult to spot. Like, if you're out in the woods here and you were like looking around and trying to find a wisteria to collect, I mean, I can't even count the number of times I've seen a wisteria. Like it no more than I can count on one hand how many times I've actually seen one. That's at ground level. They're usually pretty sneaky. They kind of blend in with some of the other vining plants that are here in Louisiana. But yeah, they'll get up into the tops of the trees, and then they are vines, so their roots can actually take in moisture. If they get into a pine tree and they get into a wet spot on that tree, and their roots will take in there, and then they'll be bigger up top, way bigger than they would be on the ground level, of course, because that's how vines usually work. And then, yeah, they'll take over the whole tree, and you'll see, it looks kind of weird, because at first they'll kind of encapsulate the entire pine tree, is what they usually climb on here, because that's the tallest trees we've got around here other than the cypresses. And then when they go dormant, it looks really weird, because you got like a bunch of little branches, it looks like, going up the entire tree, and you're like, oh wow, that pine tree looks weird. It's like it's got like a lot of little refinement, like it's like looking at a bonsai. You're like, that would be kind of cool. But it's actually that vine. It's actually a wisteria on there. I think because of the way that the weather was this year, how we had a like horrible drought, and then we had a really like unexpected, like another really harsh, like cold winter. I think the wisteria are not doing too great. I haven't seen any flowers in the past couple of years. But yeah, like you said, they need plenty of water. So I know I've seen them, but they're difficult to find here. But there was at one point, kind of like how crepe myrtles are compared to like an like highly invasive species with the Chinese tallows and stuff. The wisteria is kind of like in that same block.
In Michigan, we've got the Oriental bittersweet that's climbing and strangling our trees. That one's pretty easy to spot because of the orange berries. And then, you know, our native poison ivy will climb the trees, and it'll be a similar thing where you see this, you look at a tree in the winter and you're like, those branches don't match that tree. And it's actually poison ivy that's like 100 feet up and stretching 10 feet out. And you're like, wow, that's a that's a well-developed poison ivy.
Yeah. And you guess you could call them kind of like strangler a little bit. In a way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to a point, it's not quite as bad as, you know, strangler figs, but I mean, if they get big enough, they're going to, you know, block out the light and keep, you know, they're going to use the tree as its trellis, and eventually that tree's not going to have enough, you know, light and space to you know, keep growing.
We've got a couple of other species like that around here that kind of vine and take things over. I know another thing that's really bad is the porcelain berry up in the up in like New England states. They say that's a pretty horrible plant as well. It's kind of weird.
The problem is when they like twist around the tree, and I don't know if wisteria grows straight up or if it twists around the tree, because like with the bittersweet,
they kind of make their way around.
It twists it and then kind of girdles it, whereas like the poison ivy just goes straight up. So it's, I don't know what the wisteria does. So it's probably less of an issue than some, and I think the porcelain berry is pretty twisty as well. But yeah, it's a beautiful bonsai, but horrible invasive. But invasives make really great bonsai, actually. So
there's a reason why they're so strong.
Yeah.
yeah, a lot of invasive plants, like a crepe myrtle. Okay. I've seen someone dig up a crepe myrtle that was like almost as round as like a, it's just like a log, like on a tree, you know, like a crepe myrtle that's wider than your waist. And then cut the roots flat with like barely any, just like almost no fibrous roots left over, and then cut it to a stump, put it in a pot, and boom, it buds out. So there's a reason why they're so strong, and because they're invasive like that. But yeah, so back to the kind of like how the wisteria is kind of styled. I think it's kind of one of those trees, like I had mentioned earlier, like a ginkgo kind of has like the way it just grows with its coarse upright growth. Wisteria is similar in a way. So you can't like pad out a wisteria necessarily.
Yeah, I've seen them, you know, it's kind of informal uprights, somewhere between leaning, I guess, semi-cascade, because it's like somewhere between leaning and a cascade. Oh, that's semi-cascade. and then that's kind of what I've seen. They don't really, it's kind of like whatever the tree, you kind of want to go with its natural habit. But you can control it to some, it's a very kind of naturalist looking tree. It's not something like a pine where you really wire everything out, you know, really down and out. And, you know, it doesn't really have a distinct shape necessarily. It's kind of a very naturalistic, deciduous style.
Yeah. And generally I see a lot of people have to tilt them or have them lean, like a leaning style, or, what's that? What's the proper name for that style? Where the crown is not over the base. It's at an angle, a shotgun, which is the leaning style.
Okay.
So the apex is at like a pretty steep angle. It like kind of exists over the corner of one of the edge of the pots. And that's like, you can do that in an informal upright kind of style as well. So it doesn't really have like a, it can have a crown, but the crown is so, it's so open, like you said, kind of more naturalistic and
it's,
kind of,
yeah,
just,
it's kind of wide. It's kind of bushy. It's very like weeping willow-esque, like, you know, very rounded and flowy, because the, you know, the flowers are anywhere from 12 to 20 inches long. So you need this kind of wide open space in order to show them all off.
So you have kind of like,
it doesn't have to be organized super well, but it has to be, you know, it has to be a shape.
A lot of people will even put them kind of like in a crescent shape. Like they got like a big curve to show off that drape. Because if the tree's not cascading to some extent, it's going to have to be tall, and it's going to have an area where the flowers can clear the trunk so that the trunk complements, still has its own complementary line. Because if you have a formal upright, like a very straight trunk wisteria, that just will look kind of odd.
That would be very silly. Yeah.
Yeah. So they always want lots of angle and curve. And then you don't want them, but then again, you don't want to reach so far that they feel like they're going to fall over too. So it's
right. It's that delicate balance of, you know, you need that stability and then to have that extension. You see a lot of times that they're in round pots or like hexagonal pots. A lot of times with feet, something really stable looking to really, you know, hold them in place. Visually while they're reaching out over to the side or at an angle so that you can see the flowers. I don't know that I've seen one in a square pot. Usually they're pretty rounded or
pretty feminine. Unless they're exceptionally chunky.
You
could probably see them a little bit more of a rectangle, but even still, because of the way that they are, the bark has a tendency to be a little bit more like, this is just me kind of describing the best to my ability, like how similar they look to other things that I'm used to seeing, is like the way it looks kind of reminds me of like a fruit, like a hard exterior surface of like a fruit. Cause you can see it's got like, it's white. It's got a kind of like these weird bumps on it. And then the little or like whitish gray. But then when they're older and they have a lot of old scars on them, that's when they get really interesting looking.
Mm-hmm.
So
kind of scaly looking, not quite like the plates of a pine, but they get a little bit scaly, which is kind of pretty.
Yeah. And so there's just different, like when they're young, they look like a gray bark, kind of shiny a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Has a weird iridescent kind of feel to it, mm-hmm. The way that their bark looks. So they're not going to be so masculine that a rectangle would work for them necessarily. Mm-hmm. So,
they're much more delicate, curvy.
Smushy wood a little bit, like the bark's a little smushy sometimes. You would probably suggest more of like a pie glaze or something a little bit more like older runny glaze.
We've got a real chunky one. So it's in a unglazed pot, but it's a like a hexagonal with feet. So it's slightly more because it's slightly more masculine because it's got that, it doesn't have a bright glaze on it. But then our other one is a little bit thinner, a little bit more delicate, and it's in like a bright blue rounded pot with a nice kind of scalloped lip and feet. So it's a nice way to accentuate the chunkiness of the tree to have it in something unglazed and then something a little more delicate you can throw in a glazed pot. So it's that balance of, you know, what's the tree saying versus what's the pot saying, and how do you find that balance between the two of them?
Yeah. I see actually, like, even just doing a quick search online, you'll see a lot of unglazed containers for wisteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good way to kind of, because the flowers are so showy, it's a good way to kind of, you know, make it less ostentatious. But I really do always love them in a glazed pot too, because then it's really like, look at me. So
yeah, it's an eye grabber. And it also is like, you know, very Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
So putting them into like a not so Japanese, like bonsai traditional container, like a,
yeah,
like a big, what was the word you used? It was a good word for it.
Hexagonal
pot, or like a big giant lotus or something that's fluted, or big taller containers seem to do pretty well for them. They're not like a tree that I see very often in a super shallow container either.
No, because they're similar to, you know, the shrubs in that they want more water. It's a vine. It's very thirsty. Having more space for the roots to have more access to water is what you want to do. If you go in a shallow pot, you might need to mound it a little bit more. You might need to water it a little bit more. One other thing I want to say really quick about leaving it in a thing of water over the summer is, you know, to do that, it's one of those things too that you don't necessarily leave it in water all the time, but maybe on those hottest days is when you set it in a pan of water. So, you know, it doesn't always have to be in water when you're growing it. Just to, you know, clarify for people in case that they do want to try the grow it in water technique. Sometimes it's best to do it just on your hottest days when you know you can't get to watering it. So, not always sitting in water, but
yeah,
when it needs it.
Oh, hey, Carmen, did I tell you about Bonsai Central yet?
No, I don't think you have.
Oh, I think I might have mentioned it a few other times, but it's going to be May 3rd through 5th in 2024 in St. Louis, Missouri. It's basically the national show, but it's going to be Central America, and it's going to be an awesome show with cash awards and prizes. There's going to be a professional bonsai show and a kusumono show as well.
Ooh.
With the presentation during dinner for rewards and whatnot. But if you want to submit a tree, I think you have to submit 2 to 4 photos, and you need a brief description of your tree and send it over to the contact form at bonsaicentral.com. That's bonsai-central.com. But I think there's going to be vendors there too. Do you know what vendors were included? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard that it's going to be something like 25 plus of the best vendors from around the country. So, like, including nurseries, potters, stand makers, tool suppliers, and all of that.
But, like, specifically, I thought I heard that there was going to be American potters. Like,
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, now Tochu Take is going to be there. Vicky Chamberlain, Eli Atkins of Waldo Street Pottery, April Grigsby, Roy Minari, and Byron Merrick. Sellers of imported Japanese and antique Chinese pots are going to be there, too.
That's amazing. I mean, there must be like a pretty good lineup for this show as far as like their headliners. There should be some really good bonsai artists. Do you have any idea who that might be? I think I might have heard about Bjorn, but there's some other ones, right?
Oh, yeah. Bjorn's going to be there. Tyler Sherrod as well. Maria Hayek, Andrew Robson, Mauro Stemberger, and Young Cho.
Oh.
I think there's going to be workshops, show walkthroughs, critiques, all that stuff.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. There should be somewhere to go on bonsai-central.com, and you can fill out the opportunities to do workshops with these professionals. They have really great material, I've heard. It's going to be stuff like twisted junipers and old fused maples and really awesome pieces of material for Young's Kosumono class. So I think if you guys are interested, y'all should go check out bonsai-central.com and see if you can register for the show, sign up for workshops if they're still available. But I'll definitely be there this year.
Awesome. That's sweet.
Yeah, thank you, Bonsai Central, for sponsoring our show.
And so we mentioned soil, and then we just kind of touched on different pots and what they would prefer root work on them. Jeez, I'm starting to repot some of the wisterias at the nursery, and we didn't really talk about when to repot them, like when's necessary to do it. It's like right when they're starting to set flower buds. You can do it right before then and after, correct?
Yeah, we do ours just, you know, now early in the spring with everything. You can do it right after flowering as well. It's one of those, I find like with a lot of the flowering plants like azalea and jojoba, and now add wisteria to the list, that you can do it after flowering, especially if you're going to do a defoliation. It's a good time to do both of those things at once. But generally, we just throw it in with all the regular repotting early in the spring because, you know, unless there's a reason for us not to, unless we're super busy and we can't, but usually it's just easier to do it with everything else.
I saw in our notes. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just find everything that people are like, oh, just do it. You know, you can do it after flowering. Like you can, but for me personally, it's just,
it's better to do the work.
It's stressful to just do it earlier in the season when, you know, it's
the proper, right when buds are swelling thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't suck the energy out of the tree by messing with the roots too much.
Well, then you don't have to worry about the weather getting unexpectedly hot and having to, you know, do extra aftercare. It's just, it's more straightforward to me personally, but yeah, there's no reason that you couldn't do it a little bit later.
Yeah. And I was even reading in our notes too. It's like, it said with a little bit of leaf on them, even if there's like a few leaves extended, it's still fine. But like you said, you probably just do it a little bit earlier before that even starts to happen. I have wisteria at the nursery right now. So we grew a lot of them from seed, which I wasn't really aware of this process until I really got into the grow field and was like looking at all this. And the age thing has always been really interesting to me. The age thing comes up with a lot of different trees. I gotta say it every single time because, I mean, this is just an ongoing joke. Bald cypresses, whenever they are a certain age, they will start making knees. And so we're talking about the features of each species. Like people want to see knees on bald cypresses. They want to see flowers on wisteria. And also on hawthorns, they do the same thing. Hawthorns have to be a certain age before they start flowering as well, correct? Because that's something I've read. You know, we read these things everywhere. There's always like that. There's always like that stipulation. It's like, you have a wisteria, great, but how old is your wisteria? And it was like, the mark is usually like 8 to 15 years. And it makes it sound daunting, but even further to kind of like go and confuse that even more is that we've been growing these seedlings in the field for about 4 years and they were flowering when I got there. So it just adds more confusion to it.
But they're also
growing in full sun, blasting full sun.
Well, and they're growing in the ground too. So it's a situation where they have everything that they need. And it's Louisiana, so do they ever actually stop growing? Like,
they probably
they could
jump
have
a few
essentially
growth seasons.
Double their age being in the ground in Louisiana than they would in Michigan, yep. you know. But you know, the age of needing a tree to be a certain age before it flowers, I feel like that's just, it's
this
not
is
really
one of those rule of thumbs that people tell you.
Yeah, people always say that, but I always see trees flowering usually before, you know, they hit that age limit. So I don't know. I wouldn't put a lot of stock in trees necessarily needing a certain amount of age. It's one thing, like if you have a 2-year-old wisteria and you're like, oh, it's not blooming. Well, yeah, of course, it might not be old enough. It might not be ramified enough. You might not be doing the work on it that produces flower buds. I don't know what you're doing to yours in the field. I assume you're cutting them back to a certain point, which... Because otherwise, it would just be a large mass of wisteria. Yeah. So I probably, by whatever cutback you're doing, you're stimulating flower bud growth.
Yeah. And they were trimmed just to keep them off of other things. They grew into essentially was just like a hedge, like a big messy hedge. We have actually dug all of those wisteria up and put them in pots. And now they've grown out like that one I showed you the other day. Mm-hmm. That one's
are they all that chunky? Like,
yes, they are.
Send me one. I want one.
They all are monsters. they're all fat at the bottom, and then they have a long sweep depending on how they were cut. And the one that I chose to kind of start my first thing with, the pumice akadama experiment, I cut it low. I don't know if that was a bad decision or not. I mean, like you were saying, you could just grow it back.
Yeah.
But I wanted to take advantage of that chunkiness because I love. Sure. And this is something I was talking to somebody yesterday that came to the nursery. They went out collecting. It's kind of late, but they went out collecting with my buddy Nate, and they were going around looking at trees, and they were like, everything's so short and fat here. And I'm like, oh, I might have that tendency to cut everything into a pig or into a into a sumo. It's my fault. So it's one of those things I have to learn to kind of not cut back so hard.
Well, it's one of those things too, if you know the trunk's too chunky, then grow it into the next size tree to, you know, make it not as chunky looking. But
I'm also looking for taper and stuff too, so I'm cutting out really straight pieces.
You gotta start somewhere, so
I think chunky's good
to start with.
And you see these wisterias when you look online, you're looking at all the images, beautiful images of these trees, and they look too big for the container they're in. I think it's they started out small and then left them in there for how many years would you leave a wisteria in a pot? Let's just kind of start with that.
Before repotting?
Yes.
One? 1 to 3, depending on how fast it fills the pot.
We have one going on at the nursery. It's on its third year, maybe? Mm-hmm. Maybe two. I'm going to repot it when I get back to the nursery. I say that I'm done with repotting, but I've actually
You're not
got...
done re-
Yeah, I've got like 10 trees right now I can think of because me and Caitlin went to the nursery yesterday. She was helping me organize things. And I pulled like 10 trees inside. I was like, I could repot this and this and that. And I just was like lining shit up. And then we have all of the wisteria that I was going through. And me and you had just talked about it a little bit. And I noticed that they were chunky. And I was like, why do I keep forgetting about these things out here? You know, and it's because I'm running this nursery with thousands of plants. But But yeah, I've always had a big interest in obviously deciduous, but like in wisteria, I love the thought of them. If I could figure out how to make them work, and then I could have like a whole nursery full of blooming wisteria, better believe like from the street, people
want wisteria. People can't find old chunky wisteria. You're on to something. Like keep going, plant more now, get another batch going because. Once you set those up, they're gonna go like
go crazy.
Hotcakes. They're gonna go like hotcakes.
Some of the wisteria we had behind the building, like you say that's funny. Like because I brought this up a little earlier in the conversation. I'm like, well, there's the Japanese red maple and I did a quick Google while we were talking. I like Googled wisteria bonsai and it's like it's kind of sad. It's like purple rain wisteria seed starter kit. And I'm like, purple rain? What is that? but whenever I have them at the nursery, I've had probably a dozen of them that I put into basic training pots, and I was just kind of trimming them back, and then in the springtime they would put on like 1 or 2 flower buds, and then boom, they're gone. People would buy them.
Yep.
And so That is a thing, you know. It doesn't matter how pretty or chunky the trunk is. Like, I love chunky, gnarly trunks, and they give you that automatically. But if it was the simplest wisteria with like a little thin line, and when they're intentionally like cut back and they get scarred, and even like a 1-inch trunk that just kind of has a little bit of movement in it, mm-hmm. comes up to a nice point, that's still charming.
Super interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's
people will buy anything with a flower, like, yeah. And that's why they force all the perennials and sell them to you in flower. Like, you're going to sell a lot more daisies that are in bloom than daisies that aren't in bloom, whether or not it's actually the season for daisies.
Yeah. That's why I'm sad about my, I brought that up to you earlier about the violas. I had this violas growing in that purple, little soft, rectangle pot. I'm just like completely enamored with them. I love those, little guys.
I love them too. They smell so good. I went and bought a bunch of them.
The violas are violas. They're just kind of like a one shot annual, and they get all stringy and stuff, which makes me sad. But I'm gonna try to cut them back.
If you cut them back, they'll come back.
So, okay, we're just gonna sidebar. Me and Carmen are gonna talk about Kusumono stuff for a second. But I'm sure y'all don't mind. But I have a viola. There's violets, violas, and is there another species? I guess very similar pansies. Name. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Pansies. They're like the larger flowered violas. Mm-hmm.
So they're all like kind of the same in a way, but they're not the same.
Yeah. So the violets, like they're kind of like your native, or I mean, they're not all native to, you know, North America, but are they? I don't know if they are. Anyway, there's multiple violets. Species of perennial violets in the woods everywhere, whatever. And then the ones that you get at the nursery in the spring, you get pansies or violas, which are essentially, you know, modified violets for your annual beds. And a lot of times those will reseed themselves if you let them go. But usually when the weather gets hot, they'll kind of get stringy or crap out on you and die back. But once they start getting stringy, you can cut them back and they'll give you another flush. But a lot of times, you know, it's not going to be as nice as that first bloom in the spring.
Yeah. I know one of the things that I had going on is that I got my violas in that pot. Mm-hmm. They bloomed for me like automatically. Like it was like they had probably 5 or 6, and then I put them in the pot all together. It was like one of those bowl pan tray things where they had a bunch of them stuck in there. So I just shoved them all in the same pot together. Mm-hmm. I didn't even bother really putting in bonsai soil I put in there. I just regular potting mix. And then the next week, it tripled. There's probably like, there's like 30 flowers in there now.
Yeah.
But then I noticed as soon as the next batch of flowers popped up, there was in my granite, I have crushed granite for my bonsai garden. I had a seedling pop up. It was a viola just popped out of nowhere. And I don't know if that viola is going to be like, just like the parent plant.
I think it will, unless you have multiple kinds in there. So I think it'll probably self-pollinate and be the same thing. That's the nice thing, especially about where you are. You're warm enough.
If it happens faster.
It'll happen a lot faster. And, you know, sometimes here they don't reseed as readily or as, what's the word? Like, consistently. There you go. They're not as consistent, but you might have better consistency with how much you're going to get from reseeding. But I love violets as Kusumono. They're great. There's so many kinds. I have a yellow one. I've got like the dog foot. I've got like the wood violet, the yellow one. There's another pinkish one that I found here in Oregon. Like there's so many violets and they're so easy to grow and they're so pretty.
Yeah. I find a couple of violets, and it's like the small little mini ones here. We have a wood violet and a bog violet that grows here.
Ooh, a bog violet? I'm going to Google that because I am not familiar with a bog violet, and I like how that sounds.
Hey, everyone. This is John Eads, founder of Left Coast Bonsai and proud supporter of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast. I'm breaking into your feed today to let you know about a few exciting things we're doing here at Left Coast Bonsai. We're a small, family-owned bonsai nursery that's focused on producing high-quality bonsai plant material, as well as sourcing hard-to-find supplies for growing in your own yard. For many of us, winter is a time to pause and reflect on the year ahead, Now's a good time to decide what seedlings and supplies you need for the upcoming season. We have a large selection of seedlings that will begin shipping out mid-February for our spring season. You can also order baskets, felt bags, or aluminum wire. In addition to the seedlings and supplies, I also teach classes and study groups on a broad range of subjects, including growing trees from scratch. I hope to hear from you soon and would love to talk about how we can support your bonsai growing journey. You can find us online at leftcoastbonsai.com, on Instagram at leftcoastbonsai, or send me an email at talk@leftcoastbonsai.com. Cheers.
But yeah, I really like those a lot. Since we were talking about flowering and stuff, there is one more thing to mention about, yeah, the bog violets are the white with the little purple kind of spattering underneath the orchid extension. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're beautiful. They grow here a lot and they're really, really small. They look like they barely would fit on the edge of your pinky fingernail.
Oh man, I need a bog violet.
Yeah. If I find some, I could
send them
to
me.
You. I don't know if they're going to survive, but I'll get you the bulk.
There's common blue violet, downy yellow violet, kidney-leaved white violet, American dog violet, and many other species. Over 680 species.
Just in North America?
In
your range?
From multiple... Hold on, I'm Wikipediaing it now.
Oh.
APC. Oh my god. Yeah, there's a lot. There's over 600 species of violets. Wow.
Yep.
I got crazy. More to go. I got to get more violets.
You got to collect them all.
Catch them all.
Catch them all like Pokemon. But yeah, talking about seed bodies, one more thing I feel like we could bring up and then we'll start to wrap up here is wisteria do make seeds. They look like green beans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're in the legume family.
Legume?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bean family.
Oh.
beans and peas, the legume family.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. That makes sense because the flower, but no, yeah, they look like a giant green bean, which is kind of funny, and they got like a fuzzy exterior to them.
Uh-huh.
You could plant those Yeah. So it's just like, and then I've seen a couple of people where they'll display their wisteria and they'll be like, look how interesting the flowers are. But then they'll have like one where there's like the seed pods are like hanging off of them and it just looks really strange.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a feature. I know the ones at the nursery, that we don't really touch very often, they'll just be covered in those seed pods and they'll just be hanging out. Yeah. And people are like, what in the hell is that? And I'm like, I didn't really see that until I was at the nursery. We got a full cycle of blooms and then that was hanging out. I was like, oh, well, I learned something about these wisteria. They're very, you know, that's the full cycle of them, obviously. But well, yeah.
A lot of times, you know, people cut back their plants after they flower and you don't see what the seed pod actually looks like. And so whether it's on a bonsai or on a perennial or whatever, sometimes letting them go to seed, honestly, violets too, if you let your violets and violas go to seed, like they look like little monsters. It's like a triangular thing with like, it looks like the Demogorgon from like Stranger Things, like the mouth. It's like, wah.
Yeah.
It's really funny looking. But yeah, seed pods are so interesting, especially for Kusumono and, you know, out of season display. Columbine seed pods, leave your columbine seed pods on because you show those in the winter. Ooh, amazing.
It makes me sad that columbine don't grow in Louisiana. Yeah.
Just refrigerate them. You should just get some and then after they're done flowering, just stick them in your fridge because like, they're small. You could do it.
We'll try it out. I've been told the like stick the cold climate trees into the refrigerator thing so often.
Well, I mean, it's much easier with perennials and little herbaceous plants than a tree. But yeah, but just get a large walk-in cooler and you'll be fine.
It can't be that easy. Also, yeah, walk-in cooler. I'll have my greenhouse finally set up, but then I'll have to get a walk-in cooler installed.
Yeah,
so I can have my columbine collection.
People you'll be able to board their trees and then they'll be able to have all this crazy shit they can't ever have in Louisiana.
I think we're past swearing.
That's too complicated.
On the note of swearing, just right there, where you like correct yourself. I think that's just like, no, I think after our listeners get into like over 30 minutes of listening, it just,
if you've been here for 30 minutes, we're just going to start.
Yeah. Just start dropping it. Yeah. But anyway. But yeah, I think that was a good coverage on wisteria. Was there any notes that you think that we left out on accident?
I think that's pretty good. I'm curious, what were you using for your bonsai soil before Akadama pumice?
We just have a standard mix that we run here. So the previous mix was pumice, lava, and the lava was really small. I'm not sure why it was so small. And then this particle called True Grow. It's kind of like a fired clay particle, came from Texas. Okay. It's mined in Texas. And then we had pine bark in there. I took the pine, me and Doug got together. We talked about reprocessing the way that we make our soil, and I want it to be more in line with Boone mix. So I do lava, pumice. True Grow can stay in there because that's kind of like his, he contributes that to the soil mix. He swears by it because it's rooftop gardening soil that they use that has a high capacity for water. And he says that it could be an Akadama replacement for people who are scared for Akadama, but we know where that goes. It's a rabbit hole. But I will take that soil and add Akadama to it. And I think it's wonderful. That's what me and a couple of other people who go to that next level with soil mixing. I've been told our soil is great. And then you add Akadama in there and it's gold. I don't know about the True Grow yet, but everything loves water here so much. I think the True Grow just in the equation might just function just as well as like a pumice.
Yeah, I'm curious about that particle. I'm not familiar with it, so I'm gonna look into it a little bit and see.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, like when you get back to Michigan, it might be easier for me to ship you a tree that has something that has that mix with it, and you'll just see how it's working. See how it works there, because I know in Louisiana it works fairly well, but yeah, it's,
how does it relate to, is it similar to turfis, or is it, do you know?
No, the argument that it's not haydite, it's not turfis, it's there's a whole data sheet on it, and I can pull it from our
send me the data sheet if you can, because I can't I'm googling and I can't quite find it, but I'm curious.
I don't know where he sourced it or how you found it. I know we're kind of going into some deep stuff on the soil mix here on the show, but
we don't have to leave this in either if you want to.
It's nothing that, like, I don't want to, like, I'm not trying to pull the wool over people's eyes about what our soil has in it. Mm-hmm. Like, you should be transparent about those kind of things, especially if you're a professional bonsai nursery. But yeah, at the same time, I do have access to lava, pumice, and Akadama, all separate components. So some of my trees that I will personally work with, I will mix my own soils, especially after having worked with you and Michael when I was up there. I love that process. It gives me much more control, and I'm not guessing on certain root issues that I might have. There's just a lot of things that go into that, and there's also time constraints when I'm repotting trees. It's just so much easier to grab my standard bonsai mix at the nursery, just throw it in there.
I mean, if it's working for you, and that's the thing with bonsai soil, everybody's gonna have a different mix, and if it's working for you, like,
just go with it,
hands off, you know, like,
yeah,
right. It's one of those things, if you're not having problems, then you have to change it.
With our soil mix, I see it as, like, if it's clean and if it's been sifted properly, which it always is, because Salvador has become amazing at that process, where we have the big giant sifter that has a little motor attached to it that shakes all the fines, and then we put it into a cement mixer to mix it. I mean, it's a beautiful process, and he can mix 200 gallons of soil in like an hour. I mean, it's amazing. It's pretty great. But anyway, so yeah, let's go ahead and start wrapping up. So if you guys made it this far to the episode, thank you guys so much for listening. Of course, we are the little things. And so if you want to support the show, of course, go over to patreon.com/ little things for bonsai people and support us at whatever level you can afford. You don't have to, I know you don't have to give us $5 a month. You can give us just the bonsai bud, the $1 a month, whatever works for you. Every little bit helps us build our show more, keeps us going. Because now we're over a year old with our new cast.
70 episodes, man. That's
70 episodes. That's
pretty
great.
Impressive.
Yep. I can't wait till we hit that 100, and we'll see what kind of height we'll feel then. It'll probably be the same. I've listened to some podcasts that I've been listening to for like almost 3 years or so. And these one guys, they hit like episode 400 and they were like not even fazed by it. They were like, welcome to episode 400. I'm like, god dang. But anyway, but they're also weekly as well, so it's not, you know, But anyway, so yeah, thanks for supporting our show at that level, whatever level you choose to support us at. Buy some t-shirts over at underhillbonsaistore.com under the Little Things tab, and that supports us even further. Also, you get really cool shirts. I'm terrible with last name. Sorry, Lee. Our Hist Warrior in our Bonsai Best Bud list. He has made just about all of our designs. He's set all the designs and the graphic work on those. And then, of course, Jonathan Wagner at Unhallowed Designs. He has run our shirts in print, and I've gone through and I've put my hands on the shirts and looked at the way he's screen printing. Everything is just top notch. So thank you guys so much for making those shirts happen. And thank you guys that are wearing our shirts out in the wild out there. Seeing the shirts in the wild is mind blowing. Thank you guys so much.
It's so fun.
And then of course you can go over to underhillbonsai.com, not with the store. I have some articles I wrote. I'm trying my best to get back into article writing as we get past repotting season. And then, yeah, if anyone's local enough, if you can drive a few hours from out of town, please check out Save Bonsai 2024 this year, March 30th. And then Carmen, where can they check out your stuff at?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai, and check out the Purple Pot Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group. We are working on getting some online programming on for this year. I think our store is open with t-shirts.
No way.
Yeah, go check it out. We got some stuff happening. Finally, woo, it's been, you know, it's hard as, you know, we're all of us running it, or me and Sam anyway, we're moms, we got kids, we're doing bonsai, you know, life is busy. So it's really tricky to keep up with it. But I'm looking forward to, you know, doing more with that in the next year or so as well. So, yeah.
And yeah.
And if you're interested in Michael Hagedorn's seasonal program, by the way, check out Cortegas. Is it CortegasBonsai.com? I don't even
it's
know.
It's Cortegas.com.
There's no Cortegas.com for the seasonal schedule and awesome blog posts, etc. from Michael Hagedorn.
Yep. And then for Mike, we get Mike every so often, but we love him, of course, and we'll always shout him out. Go over to KitsuneBonsai.com. Go see Mike's offerings. He's doing a lot of online courses. He's running a couple of show-in study groups across the Southeast United States right now. And he's even starting to reach out to California and the New England states. You know, awesome job, Mike. Keep grinding. But also with baby Amelia in the world, might be a little bit more challenging for him. So support him as much as you guys can for new bonsai poppy out there. Yeah. And congratulations multiple times, Mike and Lisa, on that course. But yeah, go over to kitsunebonsai.com. Check him out, see what he's got going on, and show him some love on Instagram at Kitsune on Instagram. He's always posting his progressions of his Shohin bonsai that he's been developing for years now, and he's got some great work there.
He does,
Yep. So anyway, thanks for hanging out, Carmen. Thanks for talking about Wisteria. And
always a good time.
Yep, definitely. And for our listeners, thanks for hanging out with us, and we will talk to you guys next week.
Catch you on the flippity-flop.
Yep, flippity-flop later.